Kirsty. This episode is another landmark in the podcast series, and for the second year in a row, the podcast was recorded in front of a live audience at the Wonky Festival of Higher Education at Senate House, University of London. This time, my guest is Nick Hillman, director of HEPI, the Higher Education Policy Institute, who creates an intensively residential institution, the seductively named Vale University, rooted in the English tradition and based in the worst place in the country to live, apparently. The aim is for the university to be the first of a chain of institutions with particular specialisms and based in coldish but interesting spots around the country, with outstanding architecture and exceptional transport links, including HS2. The residential experience is critical though, as is ensuring everyone is in the same position. So the aim is to have no more than one student from every sixth form, and all of them will experience identical semi-Spartan accommodation and communal dining. There are no en-suite or self-catering offers at Vale. Illegal drugs are banned, but there is a huge range of social and community activities to keep students and staff engaged every single day. Vale's prospectus is a broad one, with a particular emphasis on languages and French history, reflecting the origins of its principal campus building, and a strong extramural programme to cater for a highly engaged local community. All staff, including the Vice-Chancellor, are very involved with students and do their utmost to care for everyone. Sport is for all and no one cares about rankings, although there is close attention paid to academic standards and the impact of research. There are many other exciting features to Vale, including an anthem commissioned from a famous badger-loving rock star. And the questions from the floor, which have had to be relayed by the host because of the poor recording quality, apologies for that, extract even more detail from Nick about this remarkable institution. It's a fantastic vision and a really entertaining recording. I do hope you enjoy it. This is a live recording of the semi-popular podcast in which notable sector figures put their creative brains to use and come up with their imagined, imaginary, ideal, entirely fictitious, maybe a foothold in reality kind of institution. And the exciting and dangerous element of this for me is that I've had no conversation with my guest today prior to this session. So all I've got as much idea about what he's going to say is you have. What I have done though is give him a list of prompts to think about, and I'll ask him a series of questions and we'll have a dialogue and then we'll see how we get on. There's an element of edginess to this for all of us. So for those of you who don't know me, my name's Paul Greatrix. I'm registrar at the University of Nottingham and also a previous long-time contributor to Monkey and do other stuff as well. And one of the things I dabble in is this My Imaginary University podcast, and there's a big back catalogue of exciting previous recordings. But my notable guest today is Nick Hillman, who will be known to many of you, who is formerly a student at the University of Manchester and a PGCE student at Cambridge, history teacher, and also a research officer for David Willetts, and then a policy officer for the pensions, the Association of British Insurers, where he worked on pensions, parliamentary candidate, local election candidate for the Conservatives, and again, a special advisor from David Willetts. But most significantly, he's been director of HEPI for a decade now, an impressive record in higher education policy. And perhaps even more impressive is his eclectic and wide-ranging musical taste, which may emerge during our discussion. So more on that later. And I know some people might be hoping for a light-hearted event. Unfortunately, I only ask dull questions. So if there's any lightheartedness, it's, well, we're depending on that. So we'll see how that goes. Right, so let's go with the big picture then, Nick. I've asked you to create an imaginary university, so give us the headlines about the kind of institution it is. Is it in this country? Is it multinational? Is it in space? We have had one in space. Give us the headlines on your university.
Well, I should say the reason Paul and I haven't talked about this in advance is because I've been avoiding Paul for about 18 months, because since he you first asked me to come and do this on the podcast, because I found it one of the most challenging questions anybody's ever asked me since I've been working in higher education policy, because I think the very process of designing a university is almost exclusionary, because you're saying there's a bunch of things that happen by definition, therefore there's a bunch of things that don't happen. And we've had some very interesting family conversations over the dining room table about this. And my daughter, who's 12, said it should only specialise in courses about One Direction and Maisie Peters. And my son said he didn't care what it did, so long as it was next door to Chelsea Football Club. So my family weren't a huge help in this. And I'm probably going to make myself even less popular in the sector when I tell you the sort of institution I think we should have. Because it is very much rooted in the English style of education that I think, if I'm ever remembered for anything in higher education, it might be, and I probably won't be remembered for it, but it might be for popularising the phrase boarding school mob. And people always think I mean it as an insult at the sector. And actually, I think a proper community where everybody feels like they belong is actually that collegiate environment. It has great power. The problem is we apply to 8-year-olds and we apply to 13-year-olds. And actually, it comes into its own, I think, at 18. So my model is, you may think it's a horribly traditional institution. My model is very much an institution where people live there. It's got a collegiate environment. Everybody is equal. We might even have means tested fees so that nobody has to work during term time, because everybody, the really rich, will be paying for the less rich. We're also going to have a massive endowment. This is an imaginary university. We're going to have a massive endowment that's going to mean we can do all sorts of things. And it's either going to be from somebody very rich, like Richard Branson, or I'd quite like it to be the royalties from somebody, the way that Great Ormond Street has had the royalties from Peter Pan for 100 years. I'd quite like that. So I think maybe we'll try and get J.K. Rowling's royalties for 100 years, or a good, you know, Christmas song or two where the royalties plough in every year. So I have tried to think about this in a sort of almost resources are no limit.
Yep.
And I have even chosen a venue, by the way, which I know Andy Westwood's in the room. He will know very well, which is the town closest to where I live is Ellsbury in Buckinghamshire, which was recently voted the worst place in the country to live. And I think one of the reasons it was voted that is because it doesn't have much of a university. It does have a small outpost of Bucks New University, which is great, but most people aren't even aware it's there because Bucks New is more associated with High Wycombe and Gray Missenden and other places. It would not be voted the worst place in the country to live if it had a university. And there's a very nice National Trust country house called Harwell House there, which is very historic. Louis XVIII of France lived there when Napoleon was in charge of France. He even signed his succession papers for France there. The G7 was held there a decade ago. And we're going to take it from the National Trust, so I'm not a fan of the National Trust, not because of the woke stuff, not because of any of that route, but because they paint every one of their properties in that olive green paint.
Oh,
their shops. And their shops are all the same, and they don't need to own a country house at all. And it's called Harwell House, and it's also got HS2 goes right through the grounds. It's exactly halfway between London and Birmingham.
Nice.
And we're going to have a university station on HS2, like Birmingham University Station, so we can get to Birmingham or London in probably less than an hour. So we're going to satisfy a cold spot. We're going to have fantastic transport links. It's going to be part of a chain, so it's not going to be named Ellsbury University. It's going to be named Vale University, and they're all going to be named after geographical features. So we might put one in Swindon and call it Ridgeway University, because Ridgeway is the oldest road in the country and Swindon Leeds University. So it's going to be part of a chain.
And are you going for cold spots then? I mean, is your chain going for cold spots, or just places that have significant geographical interest that you can name them after?
Well, quite a lot of people said to me when I said, what should I do? Including my children again. She said, put it in London. London's great. And I said, no, London's got enough universities. London is the one place in the country it's definitely not going to be, even though I'm a fan of London universities and University of London and so on and so forth. So I'm going to look for towns, interesting towns that need a university. I mean, Hereford's sort of getting one in Enmite, but yeah, Maybe it doesn't need it. Peterborough is sort of getting one. He is getting one slowly in the area. But places like Ellsbury, places like Swindon, I'm sure there are places in other parts of the country that I know less well that would benefit from one of these as well. And we're going to name, it's going to be like River Phoenix's family. We're going to be named after geographical features, sort of Vale, Ridgeway, River, maybe.
Not very exciting, but we'll leave that aside decide at the moment. The team can work on that.
More exciting than the most universe names we have.
Admittedly, yes. And we'll come to the logos later. But the, okay, so it's in this kind of country house, and the other ones will be on a similar kind of style, yeah. I assume. How big is that? I mean, how many beds?
Yeah, it'll be based around the country house, like Nottingham or York, or to give it a sort of historic centre. But it will have lots of modern buildings on the campus. Right. But they'll be built in quite a traditional style, and obviously tech built into them, but they'll be beautiful. I mean, there's a story in the newspaper earlier this week that people who live in ugly buildings are more likely to feel lonely. They're less likely to feel a sense of belonging. So they will be beautiful buildings. When I'm on the board of Buckingham University, which has its challenges, but when Anthony Seldon was there, he insisted every new building was almost more beautiful than the buildings they already had. And I think that would be part of it. And another idea, by the way, I got from Buckingham, although this is not how Buckingham is run. I'm floating the idea of it actually, the institution being owned by the academics. So it wouldn't be a charity. It wouldn't be publicly owned. It wouldn't be for profit. It would be more like John Lewis.
Yeah.
And so the incentives for academics. So if the academics are on the picket lines campaigning, they'd be campaigning against themselves because they physically own the institution. They're like a partner in the institution.
Is it all staff in the university or only academics? Because, you know, you can have a two-tier issue.
No, absolutely wouldn't be all academics. You would need to have been at the university for a minimum amount of time, and you'd need to be probably at a certain level of seniority. But no, not a division between academics and professional services. Right. If you moved there, Paul, you would be allowed to be a partner as well.
Excellent. I can hardly wait. So it's a decent size. It's got some nice buildings, lovely parkland as well. So tell us a bit more about that campus environment and what you're delivering.
So I think it would have about 10,000 students. Right. And one of the reasons I've gone for about 10,000 students is it would be about, I'm going to talk about undergraduates to begin with. It would have some postgraduates. But imagine it had about 3,000 new students each year, undergraduates. You could then offer, I think, there's about 4,500 sick forms in the country. And I'd quite like to say we're going to have one student from every sick form in the country. And we're actually going to limit it. No school will be allowed to send more than 5 people to this university. Because I don't like the idea. I know this is a heretical idea, but I don't like the idea in education that you stay with people all the way through. You know how, for example, senior schools are linked to junior schools and you go through. And I think education should have very clear break points where you can reinvent yourself as a person. You can just be a completely different sort of person. And so I don't want cliques of people moving en masse, whether the schools abroad or in the UK. So I'd quite like, I think I'd have a limit of no more than 5 people from any school in each cohort, but I'd quite actually like just one person from each secondary school, because that would make it properly diverse. If you have one person from every sick form across the country.
I'm just thinking through the logistics in terms of UCAS processes, if I'm honest.
Said imaginary. And remember, it's a chain. So if they can't get a place at Vale University, right, they can go to Ridgeway University. They can still go to somewhere with the same ethos.
Yeah. But I think I understand what you're saying about ensuring that everyone's then in the same boat, aren't they? So they don't have friends that they can immediately...
Nobody knows anybody.
No. Okay. Right. Okay. That's it. That's interesting. So you've got these new intake of undergraduates, none of whom know each other, all in the same boat. Are you recruiting internationally as well, did you say?
Certainly people from, if they like the ethos, but it's not designed to be a stellar, world-class, top-of-the-world rankings university. It's designed to be, one of your questions you asked me to think about was league tables.
Yeah.
And the only league table I want it to come top of, and it doesn't currently exist, is a sort of anti-bullying league table. I know bullying tends to be something we talk about in relation to schools, but I think universities can be environments in which both students and staff actually can be bullied. And the only league table I'm interested in coming, you know, which is sort of linked to happiness and well-being, yeah, but I actually want it to be that everybody on campus to feel happy, contented, safe,
yeah,
100% of the time, yeah, which won't be easy because it will be an open campus for locals to come into. And it will have a really big extramural department,
yeah,
for the evenings for locals. This is going to be rooted in the locality is in the extramural department, which will be largely unaccredited, but academics talking about their obsessions to the local community.
And so but it's fundamentally a residential community, which everyone is resident. Is that right, then?
Yeah, I think even local people would be expected to be resident. And the accommodation is going to be exactly the same for everybody. The other thing my daughter insisted upon was everything should be ensuite, but actually my rule is going to be the opposite, unless you've got, you know, particular needs for where you may need ensuite. But it's going to be quite vanilla accommodation. So you're not going to want to spend lots of time in your room. Your room will be quite sparse, quite basic. There will be community meal times, so you will be expected to eat as a community. And there'll be tables where, if you just want to meet some new people you've not met before, that's the table where everybody talks to everybody. And it will be, so it will be quite traditional. Like it is an environment. One of your recent people talked about a monastic environment. This is not a monastic environment, but it is a collegiate. You know you are a member of an institution.
And what other means do you have of encouraging people to embrace that non-monastic but quite similar to monastic lifestyle?
Long corridors, lots of things like team sport, not just for people who are good at sports, people for every availability.
Yeah.
Orchestras,
yeah.
Social events. We're going to have lots and lots of gigs, and we're going to have a place where I want really big stars to sort of do the rehearsal for their world tours at it. So we're going to have big, you know, the way that the Rolling Stones played in Oxford College before they were big, or there was even a school the Beatles played at before they were big. We're going to have live music every night, and there's going to be lots of social. There'll be something to do every.
Wow, that it's ambitious, but exciting.
The money's no object, as I say. We're going to have J.K. Rowling's money and means tested fees.
So it's a very lively environment, then, right? But and I can see how students would be engaged with that lively environment, and obviously not want to go back to their Spartan cold rooms.
Yeah.
But what about what they're doing during the daytime, then, in terms of the study? What range of courses are on offer in your distinctive perspective?
We will have the full range of courses, but I want them to be rooted to the local area. So by that, I don't mean dull local history. I mean, you know, the first flagship one, Vale University in Harwell House, where Louis XVIII lived, will have, for example, a specialism in French history. The one in Swindon, Ridgeway University, will have a specialism in transport, because the reason Swindon exists as a big place is because of the railways in the Victorian time. And it will be quite hands-on. So you will also get credited as part of your course for doing other stuff. I think it's outrageous, for example, the students who come and write HEPI papers, and we've got HEPI paper out later this week, written by one of our interns, and another one next week, written by another intern. And the one next week is written by a second year student at the University of Oxford. Brilliant paper. He won't get any credit at all from the University of Oxford for writing that. But you will get credit for, whether it's work-based learning that's linked to your job, whether it's probably not if it's working in a bar unless you're doing an events course, but there will be opportunities to accredit other things you're doing. Yep. We will have the full range of disciplines, but with a particular focus on languages, because I think perhaps one of the biggest problems facing English UK education is the terrible collapse of language learning, and there will be a particular focus on language. And we might have exchanges with other universities where hundreds of our students go and do exchanges en masse.
I'm just thinking about the kind of curriculum experience then. So are they doing, I mean, they're doing the additional work that you describe for credit, but are you offering things like years in industry and whatever, you know, sandwiches and that kind of thing?
Yes, but I don't think we wouldn't be like Aston or Loughborough where that's the norm,
right?
But that is certainly available. I think we'd be more innovative when it comes to PhDs. So we would not give anybody a PhD unless what they've written is already publishable quality. So there'll be no PhD for anybody who's got to rewrite their thing so the non-experts can understand it. So every PhD, you only get your PhD once a publisher has agreed to publish it as it is.
So that seems like a perversely high standard, given your willingness to embrace mediocrity in other aspects of...
No, we're not willing to embrace mediocrity, even though, as I say, we would take one better. We're looking for potential, and we're looking to spark that. One of the reasons I'm quite relaxed about, for example, what bit of work-based learning they did, is I want to ignite the spark in people. So I don't mind if people end up uber specialist,
right?
If it's really lit the spark in inside them. So we're not looking for mediocrity, but we're looking for eccentrics would be welcome. Odd academic interests would be welcome. People who are obsessed with one small area would be welcome. Yeah.
Right. Okay. In terms of eccentricity, then, what is there a research program? I mean, does it align to?
There is a research program, but it doesn't. But you get double impact points if your ALPA is a think tank publication, a textbook, a TV program. You get fewer brownie points if it's an academic. I don't know. I'm not quite sure how we persuade the ref peer panels of this, but
you don't care, do you?
Well, we've got money. We are flush with money, fortunately. So it's going to be impact, but a different sense of impact to how we often talk about it. It won't be impact being in nature. It'll be impact in terms of engaging a very broad. So you do a walking with dinosaurs on the TV. You get a program. You get a think tank pub. It can't just be any old think tank publication. It has to be one that there's evidence. There's evidence that's been read.
So it's going to be a top policy think tank of that handy kind of level.
Yeah. Perhaps. But as we evidence that it's been read and engaged with by policymakers, so you can't just invent a think tank to satisfy the box. But it will be a different form of impact. So we'll be trying to, and I think that's possible even with even if it's blue skies research, you can still be thinking about the long-term potential consequences of your work. So it's not about trying to drive everybody to the end point of the research pipeline.
Okay, but there's a different kind of incentivization for particularly academic stuff on top of the kind of share ownership model that you've described as well. So it's, if you play the game, you could be well in, couldn't you?
Yeah, and I want it to be, one thing I've sort of wrestled with is I don't want it to be expert in one disciplinary area. One of your questions was, who are the famous alumni? And I want them to be could it be almost anybody from almost anywhere. I don't want to say it's definitely going to be an engineer or it's definitely going to be a historian. I want it to be, it could almost be random. But I think the challenge with that, of course, is the disciplines where it's team science and you need big teams, because I think the stars sort of tend to be individual. So I haven't quite got my head around that, but Johnny Rich can come and set up an engineering department for me and explain how the engineers, and of course, remember we've got HS2 going through it, so they can, be part
of, fast.
Be part, it's still being built. So yeah, it's still being built. So we could have, we could have people, the engineers could certainly think about fast railways, especially in the Swindon.
I still can't get my head around HS2 stopping in this small village to serve a university community before starting up again and therefore taking 15 minutes extra in its journey.
Yes. Well, I'm not too bothered about it because I regard this as the centre of the world.
And okay.
It's stopping in somewhere called Winslow, which is a tiny little place. Though 5 miles away from the University of Buckingham, so they're quite pleased, and quite near the OU. But no, we'll stop there. But HS2 is about capacity as much as it's about speed. Yeah. And it doesn't have to stop anywhere else. London, this place, Birmingham.
Right.
And hopefully on to Manchester. So,
and everyone's happy.
Yeah. So what I'm thinking about is a golden diamond. We got the golden triangle. I'm thinking about a sort of golden diamond because, Birmingham will be as accessible as London. Nottingham won't be too far away. Maybe just sneak into the diamond.
Sorry, advance notice for the audience. I will be inviting you to ask Nick some questions as well shortly. But so do have a think about the things I've completely failed to ask him. Let's talk a little bit about leadership then, Nick. Yeah. I'm assuming you're appointing yourself vice chancellor of this august institution, but maybe I'm wrong.
Might be fun. Yeah, I don't know. You asked me about the characteristics of the leader, and I think the one I wrote down was present. Well, I do want the leaders to know their students, because this is a research active institution, but it's the teaching is even more important than the research. And I remember walking around Northampton University with Nick Petford when he was vice chancellor there. And so he actually knew some of the students, and they said, "Hi, Nick," and he had a chat to them. And there aren't many VCs that I've walked around campuses with that know a material proportion of their students. So the way that Nick, I know he then got in trouble for stage diving at a gig at the student union, so I won't necessarily be doing that. But I want the vice chancellor to be present, to know a material proportion of their students, to be hosting, that the vice chancellor will be compelled to live on campus and host regular events. I would like every student to be invited to have dinner with the VC two or three times during their tenure.
What, one-to-one?
No, not one-to-one. No, maybe 15, 20.
Oh, right.
Yeah, not one-to-one.
Sorry,
not one-to-one. And I would like heads of faculty to do the same, because we're going to have a slightly different way of listening to the student voice. That's going to be the student voice. You asked a question about the student union. We are going to have a well-funded student union, but only if turnout to student union elections are at least 50%.
Right.
So if the turnout of the student union election is 50%, you get a lot of funding for your year. If it's under 50%, you're going to be denuded, I'm afraid, because because I want it's a different form of student voice. And I want the student voice to be captured partly through social events, but I also want it, I don't want students spending lots of time politicking. I want them to be out having fun. I want the student union to be inward looking, intentionally inward looking about the life of the university, not trying to settle the Middle Eastern crisis.
But, are you actively preventing people from forming groups to talk about political issues?
You did one of these with Debbie McVitie the other day, she was talking about academic points for political involvement and political engagement, and we wouldn't go down.
But you wouldn't penalise people academically for
wouldn't penalise them, no, but I think it would be a sign of failure of our university if lots of students felt they had to spend a lot of time campaigning for the student voice to be heard, because lots of people, because I say, if this is owned by the staff of the university,
yeah,
they should be delivering for their students anyway. They're not going to be out of a job if students don't want to come to this university, because they own the university. And so I want to capture the student voice in more conversational ways than through committees.
Yeah. Well, I think that'll be interesting to see how it plays out, because I think, if I've learned anything over the years, it's that student self-organisation never goes the way that you anticipate it will, because students are students,
yeah,
and you ain't a student.
No, but they're not students for very long, are they? They're not students for very long, and what they want may not be the same as what the upcoming cohorts want. And I don't want them to feel they've got to spend their time lobbying for more contact hours or their essays to come back quickly. I want that stuff just to happen.
Yeah.
I want them to be out.
Focused on one direction.
Well, that wasn't my choice. I mean, the first one, as I say, will be Harwell House in Ellsbury, yeah, don't tell the National Trust. With deep links to David Bowie, actually, in Ellsbury, so I know you wanted a song, but not One Direction, no. Unless we can get Harry Styles' royalties.
Excellent.
Robbie Williams does own a higher education institution.
Does he? Which one, then?
But he said in an interview with the Daily Star last week, he was going to run a university, and I tweeted this out because I thought it was quite amusing, but Paul McCartney has involvement. Mike Ratcliffe, who's everything there is to know about higher education, said he does already have an involvement with, I think it's called LAS. They are on the OFS register. So if Robbie Williams can do it, it'd be quite nice to have his royalties.
Yeah. I think I'm just imagining him as a vice chancellor.
Ours is going to be a drug-free campus, I should say.
How are you?
We're going to be very liberal. We're going to be very liberal in every respect, except when it comes to drugs, because all the polling we've done at HEPI, for example, is students. Yes, there's a hardcore students who use quite a lot of illegal drugs, but the majority of students don't want to live with near people who are taking drugs or dealing with drugs. You will get expelled if there are plenty of other universities people can go to if they want to use recreational drugs. It's not going to be a big feature of our one. But I don't want, people won't want to use it. It'll be such a, it's like, I'm not a fan of science fiction. I hate science fiction because I think real life is too interesting. And I want people to feel on our campus to feel like that about drugs. So we don't need to use recreational illegal drugs because we don't feel the need to take them.
Oh, so it's only illegal drugs. So it's not, caffeine's in, is it?
Oh, caffeine's definitely in.
Right.
Yeah, caffeine's in. We will have free coffee all over the campus. There will be, caffeine's okay. Yeah, it's illegal.
I'm just thinking of the local community. They don't care about getting expelled if they're, having a bifter at one of your gigs, do they?
I haven't thought that one through. But you're not allowed to smoke inside anyway. So whether you'll have smoking, tobacco, or whatever. I don't think that'll be a problem, but maybe I'm.
So, well, let's.
I do wrestle with this because I do want the campus to be properly open. Anyone can wander in. I want the library to be full of the local sixth formers who don't have somewhere quiet to work at home coming in, absorbing it. And I appreciate that brings risks onto campus.
Well, let's explore that a bit more because, I mean, it's not just the people accessing the facilities. What about the engagement with the town council or whatever and the structures within the town?
Yeah. Well, my understanding is Ellsbury tried to bribe at one point Bucks New University to move to Ellsbury. So I think they're pretty keen to have a university and they need one. And Swindon is desperate. I made a speech when the Queen died saying we should found a new university in her name. You wouldn't believe how many people from Swindon got in touch with me saying we desperate to have a university. Can this new university be in Swindon? So I think there will be an appetite from the local burghers of Ellsbury, particularly because we are going to have this amazing extramural department. You're going to be like the University of the Third Age on campus. There'll be life drawing classes. There'll be every academic.
There are safeguarding issues. Yeah, well, around that. Maybe
every academic who's obsessed with whatever, they'll be doing, you know, leisure learning on the back of their obsession. You know, there'll be literary clubs. There'll be art clubs. There'll be, so yeah. So I do want it to be properly open. I haven't quite thought, I'm just going to trust the local community to respect this institution and its facilities. So, which may be risky, but
that's very brave, Vice Chancellor.
Yeah. Well, with our endless endowment, we can do a sort of a broken window strategy towards any.
And you will presumably have a caring but very present security.
Yeah, I don't really want any security at all, but because I want people to respect the area. But I've read, it's you, isn't it, that does the crimes on campus?
Oh, yeah.
So I appreciate that may be necessary, but it won't be aggressive. It won't be aggressive.
But I think the thing about a security team is that they're actually, most of the time, they're actually concerned with student welfare and well-being and looking after students in difficulty. So yeah. They're really the front line of your student welfare. So.
Well, yes and no, because we're going to have an amazing staff-student ratio with quite small class teaching. So our academics will know their students by name. They will, won't just be the vice-chancellor who knows the material proportion of students. Every academic will be properly trained, both in teaching and safeguarding. And I once wrote a blog, which was quite an interesting sort of thought experiment. I said, imagine the age of majority was reduced. So you know how you used not to be an adult until you're 21. Yeah. So imagine the age of majority was increased back to 21. What would you as a university have to do you don't currently do?
Oh, God.
And then I said, but of course, that's never going to happen and shouldn't happen. So you then take it away again. But what is left that you probably should be doing even though they are adults? So it would be a very nurturing, caring environment. It wouldn't be a religious institution at all, but there would be every major religious faith people from there would be represented, and none, you know, and maybe we could have humanists on there as well as part of the pastoral team.
Satanists?
No.
You said every.
Yes, everyone with some limit.
You want to, you know, things you have to grapple with in universities these days, you know, the range of faiths.
This is why I've been avoiding you for 18 months, Paul, because I didn't want to have to answer these difficult questions. But could I say that I don't, my first point was, I don't like this question because it's, by definition, you design the perfect institution and then you exclude some other stuff. But I'm not saying every institution should be like my university. If other universities want to have Satanist experts or, you know, liberal recreational drugs policies, I'm not saying that has to happen on my campus.
Yeah. You mentioned an inclusive approach to sport earlier. I mean, do you still welcome elite athletes as well?
Yeah, but we wouldn't chase them because we're not chasing people who are already good at stuff. We want to make people good at stuff.
Uh-huh.
So we're not going to, we wouldn't.
So you don't care about bucks and things like that?
No.
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 Okay.
No.
Fair enough. We talked about things that you're excluding. Are there other things that you're banning? Are there particular things that you would really like to ban from your campus?
No, we are generally liberal. I mean, one of the questions you sent me before was, you know, what's your attitude towards politicians coming on campus?
Yes, yeah.
Every politician is welcome. I mean, I think, you know, even the extremist ones, but it would be part of a debate. It would be part of, they wouldn't just, you know, be part of a debate. I want it a sort of Oxford, in that respect, I want a sort of Oxford Union type feel that there are, and I wouldn't, I mean, I'm on the honours group at the University of Manchester. We have a rule that we don't give awards to serving politicians. I wouldn't even have that award. Why set yourself these silly limitations? I want it to be, everybody to feel welcome. Actually, as I said, I'm on the board of Buckingham University, which has all sorts of challenges. You know, they have, you know, the George Galloway speaking recently. They had, you know, other people. When I know he's persona non grata these days, but when Dominic Shellard was VC at DMU, De Montfort University, he gave an award to David Cameron while he was Prime Minister because of legalising gay marriage. Whereas you wouldn't get that through, in Manchester because we don't give awards to serving politicians.
Yeah.
So I'd be very liberal about all this stuff because I trust our staff who own the institution not to give an award to Assad or something, you know, but to think about the long-term reputation of our institution. But I have very few rules like that. I mean, you talk to us about regulation as well. I want quite light touch regulation at the institution.
Oh, well, go on then.
Well, I you wrote a very good piece first talking about a national student record system.
Yeah.
So there'd be data on our students, which someone could pull off your national student record system. And so long as the data was positive, I hope Sir David Behan would be quite light touch about our institution. But we would have quite a robust robust, we would have quite a robust external examination system, probably more robust than the standard ones. Right. And we would, some of our courses would be off the shelf curricula. So I'm not, you know, so just like people who set up new medical schools normally buy somebody else's medical curricula and start teaching it. I'd be relaxed, for example, if our academics wanted to ask the British Academy what the first year history syllabus should look like, or the Royal, it's a Royal Economics Society, I think there is, isn't there? We would work with learned societies to devise first year curricula that we might then sell to other universities to use, or we might buy Nottingham's
right.
first year curriculum and work from,
well, given,
work from that.
Given how wealthy you are, I think that's a negotiation we can have.
Yes, well, yeah, we don't want to reinvent the wheel, so we're willing to learn from, you know, the best elsewhere. And as I say, the reason I quite like the idea of off the shelf curricula from learned societies or other existing universities is, you know, they're tried and tested. In a way, that is a way of maintaining our quality. And we would have probably slightly more robust than now external examination system.
Okay. I mean, it's a really interesting and it feels like a really warm institution.
I hope
right?
so.
Yeah. Do you think though, right, and this is the challenge, I think, you know, your prescriptions around one person from each school, a kind of Spartan living environment, but with wonderful facilities outside the bedroom and the corridor and the shared showers and all that kind of thing. Do you think that will really appeal to the kind of 17-year-olds of today and tomorrow?
It will appeal to enough, because we only need to appeal to one person at each school. But when I go into schools and talk to year 12, year 13 people at the cusp of filling in their UCAS, it worries me how little they know in the decisions they're taking. They think the plushest accommodation is the most important thing. So I appreciate we've got a marketing job to do. Although very interesting, isn't it? When you talk second or third years about what's important, it's very different very often to what the people on the cusp of going into higher education is. So, you know, I mean, take the ensuite thing. Then they're not rugby type showers. They can still be individual cubicles. It's just, you know, no 17-year-old has an ensuite bathroom at home. Why the hell do they want one when they go away? Their room is smaller, more expensive, humid all day long. It feels weird to me. So it's quite a basic it's a community. That's what it is. It's a community where everybody, you might be much richer than me, but we're having a similar quality of life on our campus.
Yeah. Some elements of it are quite low quality, but intentionally so.
Low quality because it's the academic, the gigs in the evenings or the comedy clubs or the debating or the communal meals.
Yeah.
And the spark you have for the freedom you're given to follow your academic interests are what's going to engage you.
But I think that what you're actually articulating is something that Ernest Boyer articulated some 60 years ago in terms of US education, which is the idea of a particularly like accommodation-based campus community feel, where essentially what you're doing is bonding students into their university community through reminding them they are part of that community and they live together, they learn the rules and they follow the rules and they look after each other. But they also get this enrichment stuff, including the academic input from academics, as well as the social side of thing, and it's not based on drink and drugs.
I know, it sounds horribly traditional, doesn't it? But it does sound very traditional, but I want people to feel an affinity with the institution. I want people to feel all the polling we do shows no sense of belonging, high sense of loneliness.
Yes.
And you sometimes find, don't you, that sometimes the richest kids who've been at a boarding school, sixth form or something, sometimes apply for the cheapest accommodation with a communal feel, because they've sort of, we're used to living in a community. And I do want to, this is a community that everybody takes pride in. I mean, one thing we're going to do is, if ever anybody in this community takes their own life, the whole university is going to close down for a day and the whole university is going to have an inward introspection. Why has this happened? It'll be a period of mourning and a period of reflection to make sure that whatever reason that person took their own life for, no other student in this university takes their own life for that reason. You can't stop, of course, people taking their own life, you know, zero forever, but we're going to have a serious period of reflection that's going to look at that particular issue and why we as an institution have failed that student.
But you would presumably have, you know, very well-resourced welfare and support services which, you know, aren't designed, or,
well,
or you're looking like you won't.
Well, personally, I think it's a failing of our country that if the student rings up the NHS and says, can I have some support, they say, no, go to your university because our waiting lists are too long. So I don't, we would have that, but I don't want it to be so good that it's an excuse for the NHS not to do their job, because they're people, these people are also members of society at large. They're not just a member of this community. And so, you know, they are also citizens of society, and they shouldn't be only able to gather support from the campus. They should also be, they are part of the wider society. So I don't want the NHS to be able to use our services as an excuse not to do what they should be doing.
That's a difficult argument to make, but you could have, before you set up the university, fix the NHS anyway, couldn't you? So it wouldn't be a problem.
Well, yeah, it'd be good if, be nice if someone did, wouldn't it?
Imaginary NHS?
Yeah, yes, yes. So I'm not a health expert. I'm not a health expert.
Podcast to follow.
Yes.
About which I know nothing. Right, Nick, we've got one more crucial question, which is the issue of a theme song or a theme tune, some kind of anthem that will bind your community together. And you know, I know you've got some pretty niche interests, but I'm wondering what you're going to come up with that will really, you know, help the community soar.
Paul is saying that because I told him earlier that I'm going to see a band called Pop Punk Factory in Milton Keynes this evening, who do pop punk versions of all sorts of songs.
But I'm saying it because you recently went to see EMF and Jesus Jones.
Well, I did wonder about whether Unbelievable should be the theme tune, because it is the best pop song ever written. And we might actually, the guy who wrote Unbelievable, who's in EMF, he does now write pop songs for people like Rihanna and stuff, and make millions from it. So maybe we could ask him to write one. But I went through the list. First of all, I thought, well, Unbelievable, I did have on my list. I thought, what do I get by Buzzcocks? Because this is going to be responsive to student needs.
Yeah, yeah.
And there was once a happy paper called What Do I Get? And I went to see Buzzcocks in my Freshers Week, as I did go and see EMF, actually. And then I thought, there is a Morrissey song called Death on the Staircase about a suicide.
Oh, it's a classic, yeah.
Which I thought might be a way to keep a focus on well-being. But in the end, I decided we're going to have a brand new song. It's going to be, so we're going to get someone like, sadly, Jim Steinman is dead, isn't he? The sort of Meatloaf sort of song that we could all sing together, whether you're good at singing or not. So we might ask Brian May, who of course is a fan of higher education, to write a rousing, driven by you style, anthemic song that we've
featuring been, badgers.
We will have good wildlife. Despite HS2 going through the campus, we are going to have, it is going to be a place where when you're stressed with your ass, a bit like Nottingham does actually very well, you can go out, and I went to Manchester, so there was none of that. Go out and see the wildlife. So we will, and by the way, this place I've going to nick from the National Trust to do this, borders on Wadston Manor, which is a beautiful, lovely French chateau built in the Buckinghamshire countryside, so owned by the Rothschilds. So if ever the Rothschilds sell up, we might expand into there, and we'll have a massive wildlife sort of campus.
Sorry, I distracted you from your Brian May anthem.
Yeah, so probably a Brian May anthem. So it hasn't been written yet, but it would be about the institution. It would be proud. It would be happy. It would be something people could sing on the touchline. Could be played by a brass band. It would be rousing.
I'm not convinced, but you know, well, and you know, we'll hear it when we hear it.
Yeah,
Nick.
Yeah,
and we'll see what people do. Well, that was a bold choice for an anthem.
So we're now going to go to the audience for some questions. So the first question is, how do you see teaching, learning and assessment and the role of tutorials at the university?
Yeah, so we would have small group teaching. I don't think it would be one to one. It might be one to four or five. We wouldn't have any of the, I mean, we did a bit of work at Happy where we looked at, with those massive lectures with 400 people. They're largely non-Oxbridge Russell group. So I don't know if Nottingham does them, but I said,
oh, yeah, them as, yeah, very much.
We wouldn't have the 400 people in a room. We would have more, most teaching, I think, would be sort of, you know, 30, 40. But there would be tutorials where people would be tested. But it wouldn't be one-to-one, because I think that's very inefficient. I think I'm right in saying the academic evidence actually shows one-to-two, one-to-three might be a better learning environment than one-to-one anyway. We have got a report coming out. Thank you for letting me advertise a report we've got coming out on Thursday, which is about why is it the women still do better than men at Oxbridge? Across the sector as a whole, men do better than women when it comes to things like first-class honours. And we do conclude that might be partly because of the teaching environment at Oxbridge and the way the academics trained at Oxbridge may not take... the way that different ways of men and women learn into account. So we would be, I think, have to be very conscious of that.
The next audience question is about your vision, which is based on this tradition of the English boarding school, which do tend to churn out a certain type of person, perhaps lacking individuality. Where do you think this represents the ideal higher education learning environment?
Well, I would argue, I was in this room earlier with the two authors of their new book on elites, who were very interesting. It's a very interesting book, actually. I've read it. And they were talking about, their argument is the elites have been through that sort of education, but also it's the wealth that's sitting behind them that gives them the sort of worldview they have. And I think because we're taking hopefully one pupil from every sixth form in the country, it would be a proper melting pot. And so they wouldn't be from the sort of backgrounds, the people from those boarding schools. And as I say, you're going away at 18. You're going away at 18 anyway. It's just we're more aware of the community feel. I think it's a bit regrettable that often on campuses, rich people live in one type of accommodation, poor people live in others. There's two academics on here earlier were talking about bifurcation, even of the Oxford experience, where the rich students have one experience, the poor students. I want everybody to have the same student experience. So I do get your point. And I don't think it would be right for everybody. People who are so individualistic, they don't like the idea of there being a song for one institution, or it's probably not the right institution for them, in all honesty, but I hope it is the right sort of institution for people who struggle with social situations, because it's going to be a really friendly institution where you don't mind talking to anybody because you know everybody's got a shared interest. But yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I'm not sure I have a perfect answer.
Another key issue raised from the floor there. Can you just walk us through the catering options?
The catering options are going to be pretty basic. We are going to have communal meals, and you can order in your delivery if you want to, but we are going to have, we're not three meals a day, but the communal dining experience, not even necessarily in the Oxbridge way, but eating together is going to be part of it. We're not going to facilitate self-catering. There's going to be no self-catering options, maybe a microwave if you want a snack in the middle of the night. The part of the way we're going to build the community is eating together.
But eating bad food, you're saying?
No, not necessarily. Eating bad food can be a shared experience as well as eating good food.
But not one that people adaptively
want. I think
want.
I said bad food. I think.
No, you said, it's basic, you said. Yeah.
Healthy.
Okay.
God. There'll be a kebab shop for people to go to after the gig. You know, there'll be opportunities to fill yourself up on unhealthy stuff after, but that's not what the university is about.
You will have colleagues who will work this up to something that what fits the ethos of the institution. Perhaps you've not fully rounded this element of the proposition, have you?
No, I haven't.
But good news on the kebab show.
This is hard. Yeah.
Another question from the floor. As vice chancellor in your new university, which VC's style would you most like to emulate?
Well, I did mention Nick Pefford before, who I think had a very nice way with his students. We were literally walking around the campus. It was the old campus. They had rainwaters collecting books. He was walking around the campus and he actually knew some of the students. I thought it was really impressive. And he knew. Anthony Seldon, who is a bit of a Marmite character, but I feel the fact that he came from the school's world into the university's world gave him a particular sort of interest on pedagogy and how young people learn. And he wasn't embarrassed to say there are things we could learn from the school's world, which I think sometimes in HE, we think we're working on a higher plane, and I don't believe that. So they'll be warm. They'll always have time for their students. They'll trust the rest of their senior staff. They won't be micromanagers. And I don't think they'll need to be because the staff will own the institution. I think the incentives will be aligned. I'd start with a Nick Pefford or an Anthony Seldon, someone who likes other human beings, not someone who thinks someone who thinks their research is more important than other human beings.
One audience member has suggested that your imagined university really closely resembles the University of Kent circa 1980. They've proposed that one way you could make a significant difference is involving students really extensively in the governance of the university, which they didn't do at the time.
It's interesting you say that, isn't it? Because when people say which universities in our country are closest to the top of the at-risk list, Kent is normally the one that comes up. So the fact that you think I've invented an institution which is like an institution that is currently finding life hard to survive, I think tells us that maybe my institution is a bit more different to what we've got than even I thought perhaps it was. I don't particularly want students running, and I don't particularly want students involved in governing. I'm on two university governing bodies, and the students who are on there. They make a really important input, especially if they're a sabbatical officer for more than 1 year, because the first year they learn and the second year they have a real impact. But students should have better things to do than be running my university. They should be out there having fun. And okay, there'll always be a few people who, you know, I would regard it as a failure if we've got thousands of people wanting to get involved in the students, wanting to be involved in the governance of their university. They can come back as alumni and help govern the university. I want their voice to be heard, but I want their voice to be so heard and embedded in the institution they don't feel they've got to go to governing body meetings to be heard. The staff know from our communal meals what's bugging them and it's going to get it done.
You've based the university in one of the worst places in the UK. Is that so students get to build character and resilience? And because it is owned by the staff, the model is a bit like a John Lewis of universities. And if that's the case, will you have a motto like John Lewis, like never knowingly undertaught?
Yeah, that's good. That's better than any answer I could come up with. I mean, it's not actually in the worst place. I mean, Aylesbury is actually a rather lovely bit of the world, and it's going to be amazingly well connected with HS2. So, and Andy in the room who knows that bit of the world quite well, Andy Westwood will back me up, I'm sure. So but anyway, even if it was the worst place in the country to live, once my university is built there, it is not going to be. It's going to be a place where lots of people will want to go. I like your slogan. Certainly, I think it would have a slogan with the centre students. I was thinking more of a slogan along the lines of be kind or something that maybe we'll put it in Latin so that it sounds better, but you know, no one here will feel lonely. Everyone belongs. Everyone belongs. Yeah. But I quite like yours because I do want to focus on, I know this will make myself even more unpopular in the room, but I like Joe Johnson's idea of teaching intensity. We will measure ourselves on teaching intensity. So a slogan that puts a focus, teaching intensity was something that, yes, it looked at contact hours, but it also looked at class size. So you couldn't just say, yeah, we have amazing contact hours, but they're in massive group. You know, we will have our own teaching intensity metrics, and whether the OFS are interested in those or not, we will judge ourselves on teaching intensity. And so having that reflected in the slogan in some way, I quite like that. Yeah.
You could also incorporate the drugs ban in the slogan as well, if you want to.
Yes. Well, maybe in the logo.
Oh, yeah. Nick, we need to stop there. It's been a terrific ride through the Buckinghamshire countryside at a high speed, and we've learnt a lot about your very interesting university, a super boarding school for the 21st century.
Should I say two more things that I didn't say that are on my list?
Go ahead. Well, I've got to do that again though now, haven't I?
Thank you. I found it's the hardest thing I've done since I've been a happy. But every new student going to get a fountain pen, so we'll have tech on there, but every new student is, you only get your exams marked if you write in a proper pen, and you have a choice of pens that we've read. And it's also going to be, because I'm left-handed and the world is an anti-left-handed place, so it's going to be very friendly to left-handed people. So all the kit in the engineering faculty, everything will be there, all the kit will be there for left-handed people as well. You won't have those lecture things where you pull up and they only work for right-handed people.
No one knows how to use them anyway.
Well, they will in our place. All right, everybody will be handwriting.
Can I say my bit now? Right. Well, Nick, thank you for that presentation of a really exceptional and distinctive university, which will never knowingly be undertaught, I am sure, in a very obscure and up-and-coming part of the Buckinghamshire countryside. And we look forward to hearing about the future successes of Vale University and its partners. So, Nick Kilman, thank you very much. Really hard.
Well, I do hope you enjoyed that episode of My Imaginary University. There'll be more along before you know it. In the meantime, you might want to listen to the sister podcast, University Registrars Talking About Stuff, in which I chat to university leaders and registrars and others like that, all about their experiences of higher education. Just Google it. Also, you may want to visit my website, wonderfulhighered.com, where you can find lots of entertaining stuff all about the strange, wonderful and frightening world of higher education. Anyway, until the next time, thank you for listening.